Proverbs chapter 19. Book of Proverbs is God's instruction from heaven on how to live a life here on earth, as practical as can be. Chapter 19, verse 1. Better is the poor who walks in his integrity, that is, in his wholeheartedness, uncompromising, than one who is perverse in his lips and is a fool. And so we might say today, one of the sayings that's popular in our day is that honesty is the best policy. Better to be honest and be poor, and to be able to live with yourself, and to know that our lives are blessing the Lord's heart, than to make a fortune out of lying and stealing and wickedness, and know that we break our Father's heart and leave casualties on the left and on the right. And so the importance of walking in wholeheartedness, walking in integrity. Never sell your integrity. We tend to think of harlotry or prostitution as something that only occurs within the realm of sex, but that's not it. God spoke to his people continually throughout the Old Testament, and he accused them of being harlots, and it didn't have anything to do with their sexual appetites or activities necessarily. It was just that they sold themselves out. They sold out their relationship with God, the standard of what God was doing in their life, the beauty of what he had built in. They sold it out for some price. If I have a price, you know, then I'm a harlot, spiritually speaking. Now the issue is just, what's my price? Am I a low-priced harlot or am I a high-priced harlot? And so it's best just not to have a price, to walk in our integrity with wholeheartedness. I'll tell you, history is just filled with men and women who would not sell out for anything, right to the point of death. Verse 2, also it is not good for a soul to be without knowledge, and he sins who hastens with his feet. In other words, the writer is saying, get the facts first. You know, get the knowledge of what's really going on there, and then act. And that's a good proverb for some of us. You know, we hasten with our feet, you know, and then we get the facts a little bit later, and it's a bit of a mess by then. And so don't move too quickly. Again, we have a saying today, don't we? Haste makes waste. And that's kind of what the writer is saying. The foolishness of a man twists his way, and his heart frets against the Lord. This is describing the man who makes foolish decisions. He makes foolish mistakes, and then he blames God. You know, God, how come you didn't do this, you know, and how come you didn't come through, and how come, you know, and the whole thing is their own, you know, foolish decisions, their own mistakes, and then, you know, they turn around and blame God. That's a characteristic of man and of man's fallen nature that goes back quite a ways. I mean, we kind of run into it right there in the garden with Adam, don't we? I mean, he partook of that fruit that he wasn't supposed to partake of, and then when God busts him, you know, what does he say? The woman that you gave me. You know, it was her fault, and I think I remember that she came from you. And I like it. I mean, in one sentence, he puts himself two persons removed from responsibility. It's like he's saying, listen, I think you two have something to talk out here a little bit, and when you get that straightened out, then you can talk to me. And he's going to blame her, and then he's going to blame God. And God said, man, you know, I should have had a V8. You're absolutely right, Adam. What am I doing? Ready to chase you out of the garden. No, he chased him out of the garden anyway. It's a, you know, a poor excuse, that trying to blame others and then to blame God. I think that one man wrote concerning this verse, and I just think it is so astute. He said, more than we know, apostasy has its seeds in moral failure. When a man engages in some form of immorality or some form of sin against God, rather than confessing his sin and repenting of his sin, so often he'll turn away from the Christian faith and then spend the rest of his life raging against it. And he'll never tell you that. He'll never let you get a glimpse of that. It's always that he has some intellectual problems with Christianity, or, you know, he's a little more sophisticated than the answers that the Bible gives, or, you know, the life that Jesus lives and all of that. And, you know, yeah, I tried all that Christian stuff and it just didn't work and blah, 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 and all of that. And I'll tell you, if you had a chance to dig deeper and you got to know the real facts, you'd find that they were confronted at a time in their life with the truth of God's way and the truth of God's word. And then the time came where they wanted to satisfy their flesh and go after the flesh. But now, you know, they can't admit that. Now it's got to be a constant tirade against the word of God. And that's a very, very common thing. Some of the strongest and most vocal adversaries of Christianity are men and women who had significant place in the church earlier in their life. And something, you know, fabulous was begun, but they wouldn't settle the issue of the lordship, and they went their own way. And then now, rather than admit that, rather than say, yeah, that is the truth, everyone ought to walk in it, that's the right way, anyone that turns from it's out of their mind, look at my life and the folly of it, you'll never get that. You'll never get that. Jesus, he makes it so clear in that absolutely grace-filled chapter. I mean, the whole book is grace-filled. But John chapter 3, when he's dealing with Nicodemus. And then he says, you know, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever would believe in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. That, you know, he didn't come into the world to condemn the world, but that the world, you know, might be saved through him. But then he moves on in there, recognizing that there will be rejectors concerning him, that there'll be those who reject Jesus, the life of Jesus, the truth of Jesus. And then he goes on there and he says, and this is the condemnation, that light has come into the world and men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light lest his deeds should be exposed. Don't be moved. Don't be moved from the person that comes along and complains and they make their decisions and their wrong decisions and then they begin a life of opposition against the things of God. I'll tell you, if you get a chance to ever see the full story, and one day the full story will come out at a white throne judgment, you'll see that it really wasn't a problem with God at all. It was a problem with their heart. But don't you get pulled into it. Don't you get pulled off of that path because of their folly. Wealth makes many friends. Now that's sad, isn't it? Do you find yourself more friendly towards wealthy people once you find out that they're wealthy? I mean, the flesh is perverse, isn't it? Well, hey, Mr. Cleaver, and, you know, it's the old Eddie Haskell thing. Yes, hi, yeah. And if it wasn't a tendency, even of us as Christians, you know, James wouldn't talk about it in James and say, listen, don't regard, you know, the outward apparel. Don't say, oh, here's somebody that's rich. Here we've got the front row for you and that kind of thing. Of course, today, you're rich, you put them in the back. I mean, who wants a front row? But, you know, that respect of persons. And so wealth makes many friends. But you could almost put that word friends in quotation marks. What kind of friends are they if they're friends because of your wealth? You know, a classic illustration of it is the boxing world. You know, as long as a guy's making $30 million a fight, man, he's got friends. But wait till he's on the downside and then you see, how many friends does he really have? And so if someone is just a friend because of wealth, we don't really have a friend. Throw we in there, you know, they kind of dabble in that way. So. But the wealth is separated, or the poor is separated from his friend. And so because he's poor, somebody says, you know, I mean, he's got a nice outfit on and everything, and looks like, oh, he could be rich. And the guy comes along and becomes his friend and discovers it's, you know, He spent a year's salary buying that outfit. I mean, that's all he's got, you know, and then they leave him. Now, one of the things about being poor and having your friends separate from you because you are poor, at least you know who your friends are. I mean, you don't have to deal with that whole thing. You don't have to deal with the whole Elvis complex. I mean, you know, I'm never tempted to rent Disneyland for a whole night for myself, you know, to see who's my friend or that kind of thing. A false witness will not go unpunished. And it's talking about in a court of law and in life. Why? Because lies catch up to you, so don't lie. And he who speaks lies will not escape. God will ultimately punish the liar. Many entreat the favor of the nobility. Here's another thing. The nobility speaks of a man or a woman who's in power. And so when a person is powerful and it's discovered that they're powerful, people like to become friends with them in the hopes of gaining favor. And every man is a friend to one who gives gifts. Now, that's a terrible thing, but it's a fact of life. Somebody's free with giving gifts and all. I mean, the friends will start to line up. All the brothers of the poor. Now, here's the contrast in verse 7. You have the powerful in verse 6. Now, here's the poor. He doesn't have any power. All of the brothers of the poor hate him as soon as they find out he's poor. Get away from him. You know, I mean, it's a sad thing. Once you know, I can't, you know, leech anything off this guy. You know, I'm out of here. And so they hate him. How much more do his friends go far from him? He may pursue them with words, and yet they abandon him. Please be my friend. You know, I need help. I need friends. And they still abandon him because of the fact that he's poor. One of the great things is the Lord will never do that. He'll never do that. Because the Lord is never a respecter of persons. He loves the rich. He loves the poor. Verse 8. He who gets wisdom, that is, you know, godly sense, loves his own soul. He who keeps understanding will find good. And so you notice the gets and the keeps. It's important to get wisdom, but it's also important to keep it. Once you've got it, don't give it away for anything. Once you got the Bible, once you got an understanding of what God's will is, hey, don't trade that in for some kind of folly. Hold on to it. A false witness will not go unpunished, and he who speaks lies shall perish. So again, a warning to liars. Luxury is not fitting for a fool, much less for a servant to rule over princes. In other words, in that kind of a situation, both the princes and the luxury are going to be wasted because they're going to be under something that isn't going to bring the most out of them. Verse 11, the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger. And so there's just, just that good sense of God's grace. When in doubt, grace. The discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook a transgression. You know, it's a beautiful thing to look, and again, as we saw last week, something similar to that. Someone sins against you, and you notice it, and you say, as an act of my will, I'm going to overlook it. I'm just going to overlook it. It'll die with me. Nobody else needs to know. I'm just going to overlook it. It's a beautiful truth, isn't it? The king's wrath is like a roaring lion, but his favor is like dew on the grass. Now, when it talks about the king's wrath, and there's going to be several proverbs related to this, it's going to talk about the king and his position as the leader of a nation, but the one responsible for law and order. And so the idea here is the king's wrath against, you know, violations of law and order is like the roaring of a lion. I mean, it's better to, you just don't want to run into it. But his favor is like dew on the grass. The king will reward obedience, and God does too. Now, you know, it talks about, I'll develop a little further when we get to another king's wrath / lion proverb. Verse 13. A foolish son is the ruin of his father, and the contentions of a wife are a continual dripping. Now, I want to say, before I begin to elaborate on this, I know nothing of this in an experiential thing. I made a comment a couple of weeks ago related to some proverb, and some people, I think, came to a conclusion that I knew something about that practically, and I really didn't. I read a lot of commentaries to come up with what I come up with here. So, but this is a beautiful proverb here. two things that make life miserable. I mean, you can't choose two things that can make a home more miserable and all the world than a disobedient son and a nagging wife with just continual dripping. Have you ever tried to go to sleep at night with a faucet dripping in the bathroom? Just dripping and dripping and dripping and dripping. There's no hope that it will end. And that's the way it is with some women, I suppose. Now, Solomon brought a lot of trouble on himself, just as I am, even now. I'm just teasing. My wife does not nag. But Solomon had 1,000 wives and concubines. Now, you have to question his wisdom. You know, I mean, we accept the Proverbs because they're God-inspired, you know, and that. But, I mean, just in a practical deal, I mean, he had some naggy wives in there, apparently. He's going to really get graphic in a little bit. I don't know that we'll get there tonight. But just that constant, continual dripping. You know, Peter writes concerning this, and women, you'll be much more effective in a man's life by praying for him and just continuing and getting on with your walk with the Lord than you ever will nagging him. You'll force him in the other direction. Now, sometimes as we read through this, we think, well, gosh, all this stuff is just really hammering the women. What about the, you know, well, when he's talking about the lazy and all that kind of stuff, I mean, he's really, in that culture, he's talking about the men there. So these kinds of things. But, you know, to be in that kind of a house where you've got a disobedient son and a nagging wife, oh, gosh, you know, forget it. Houses and riches are an inheritance from fathers. These are something that fathers can give, but only the Lord can give a prudent wife. A prudent wife is from the Lord. Why can he be the only one that gives that? He's the only one that can make that. He's the prudent has the idea of to behave wisely. He's the one that produces that kind of a woman, and I'll tell you, when he gives you one, you're a rich man. How am I doing, hon? All right. Verse 15, slothfulness casts one into a deep sleep. Now, the amazing thing about the slothful person, who is the lazy person, is that they can, no matter how much sleep they get, they're still tired. Isn't that true? I mean, they're just so lazy, you'd think that they had just cleared a redwood forest. You know, they only got 16 hours sleep the night before, you know, and they're dying for a nap by 10 o'clock in the morning. They're just dead on their feet, you know, and that's just the way that it is with that laziness. You know, when you're lazy, it just makes you sleepier still. And that's the way that it works. You say, what are you ready to sleep? You haven't done anything yet. And then Solomon says, and an idle person will suffer hunger. Those two things go together, hunger and idleness. He who keeps the commandment keeps his soul. Obeying God's word is the best for us, I'll tell you, in every way. But he who is careless, that is, disobeys God's commandments, is careless of his ways, will die. And so reckless handling of the scripture, disobedience to God's word, has a way of ending up in death. He who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord. Now I want you to notice that word poor, because all through the Proverbs, there's a continual condemnation of laziness. Doesn't talk about pity towards the lazy. The lazy need to work. But we're talking about the poor. Now, Jesus said the poor we're going to have with us always. In other words, there's always going to be an opportunity to help the poor. But there is, in those days and there is today, there's what we call, it's been coined today as the working poor. And they work and they're trying hard and they're scrambling. And I'll tell you, when we see that kind of a situation, there's a place to be a place in our heart to help that person, to make sure they do okay, to make sure that they succeed. And the guy, he's making X dollars an hour and he's hustling and doing, and then the baby gets the ear infection and how many without the medical coverage today and who can get the prescription and that kind of thing. And that's the place where we come in And we help out the person that's in that kind of a place. And when we do it, God says, you lend to me. Listen, when you lend to the Lord, you're going to get it back. And you're going to get it back with bonus. And so he just says, you know, when you lend to the poor, you're lending to me. I'll take care of it. And he, God, will pay back what he has given. God has a way of bringing forth great interest, too, as it relates to that. Chasing your son while there is hope. I think that means chasing them before they're 2 years old. But the point is, the younger the better. Train them up in the ways of the Lord. The younger the better. I, Karen and I, when we first started walking with the Lord, our oldest daughter was 2 years old. And we got active right at that point in her life as it related to discipline and training her up in the Lord and those kinds of things. I mean, I wouldn't want to have waited a real long time on that, and much less to not train them early and then try and reel everything in when they're 13 or when they're 11 or something. The earlier the better. Train them in the ways of the Lord, the things of the Lord. Discipline them. It's just Solomon saying, parents, get active. Get active in your child's life, and the earlier the better. And don't set your heart on his destruction. Now, this is a Hebrew or a Jewish saying that means don't set your heart on their crying. When you spank them, and they're going to cry like you're killing them. I mean, they're going to cry like you're destroying them. And some kids are better at this than others, aren't they? Some of them are just dig in. You're not going to get a cry, you know, and it takes a little while sometimes to maybe produce that in the rebellion. And then others, you know, just the sight of looking at them cross-eyed, they begin to cry hysterically. But don't over-punish and don't over-discipline, but don't not discipline because of their crying. They're not going to die. It's good for them. There's other proverbs that deal with it. We'll expand on it in a bit. A man of great wrath will suffer punishment. This is the guy with a temper. He's always blowing his temper. Well, you're going to get into trouble if you've got that kind of a temper. Isn't it the truth? And so a man of great wrath will suffer punishment. And for if you deliver him, then you'll have to do it over. You'll have to do it again. And so the person that's always in trouble because of their temper, because they're a hothead, and you always bail them out of their trouble, there can come a point where you just let them bear the consequences for their actions. Let them stay in jail. Let them lose the job until they finally realize that this is something I've got to give some attention to. And so there's a place to help, but there's a place not to bail them out, or you have committed yourself to a life of bailing them out. They never learn the lesson. And so there can be that place where you just leave them alone and let them, you know, bear the consequences of their choices, and in order that they might learn from it. And I'll tell you, that's really hard for a parent, but sometimes it's necessary, isn't it? Listen to counsel, verse 20, and receive instruction that you may be wise in your latter days. In other words, early in life, you know, use the years of your youth to learn. Use the years of your youth to learn, not to rebel. Don't use those early years to rebel. Use them to learn. There are many plans in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the Lord's counsel, that will stand. We've got a lot of plans in our hearts, a lot of things that we would like to do, that we want to do, but our plans always have to be submitted, as James said, you know, if the Lord wills. And so we've got our plans, and nevertheless, the Lord's counsel, that will stand. And you know what I say to that? I say, hip, hip, hooray. I want his plans to overrule my plans when they're different plans. He's always doing something better. And so we want God to win. Nevertheless, the Lord's counsel, that's what will stand. That's what we want, because our counsel doesn't always stand. Verse 22, what is desired in a man is kindness. It's just nice to run into a kind person, isn't it? It's just good. And you read the article on the road rage. What was it, like 26,000 accidents or deaths in the United States of America a year on road rage? You know, he's talking about people passing on the shoulder on the right and on the left and the whole thing. And it was neat that I read the article, because now I know it's wrong. But I mean, anyway, they had the whole deal there, and, you know, the tailgating. And they were talking about, you know, that the fact that we get in the cars, and because no matter what we are in life, when we get in that vehicle, we're kind of hidden. And so now we can kind of bring these aggressions out and everything, and, you know, unless we, while we're passing you, yelling at you, we recognize you or something, you know, then you, it's, nobody knows that anonymous thing to it. But, you know, kindness, it's becoming rarer and rarer, isn't it? When you just run into a person that's a kind person. And a poor man is better than a liar. Better to be poor than be a rich liar. The fear of the Lord leads to life. It's the greatest life imaginable, isn't it? I don't know, don't holler or anything, but I don't know what the reaction was by your family and your friends when they heard that you were a Christian. You know, hey, guess what, I'm a Christian now. And you know, it's all right. You know, not so often. They just thought you threw your life away. They think, oh, now you've ruined your life. You know, now you're not going to be any fun at all. And yet here the writer of Proverbs says, in the fear of the Lord, that leads to life. Everything else is just existence. It's just existence. But man, living for the Lord, that's what real life is. And he who has it will abide in satisfaction and will not be visited with evil. In other words, this life in the fear of the Lord, it provides us with satisfaction, a satisfying life, and with a safe life. And I've found it to be true. A slothful man buries his hand in the bowl and will not so much as bring it to his mouth again. I want you to picture it. Now, just in case you think you've seen lazy, this is a whole different thing, isn't it? I mean, there the guy's got his bowl of rice checks, and he puts his hand down in it, and he says, is it worth it to expend all that energy to bring this up to my mouth? I mean, there are people that weigh things in life. I mean, their whole focus in life is how to expend the least amount of energy in life. And so this is, you know, I hope nobody recognizes this. No, the Lord is showing me. Hold on, wait a second. I'm seeing sixth row. I can't lift this up. That's too heavy. I'll spend more calories than I'll get. Strike a scoffer, flog a scoffer, and the simple would become wary. In other words, when someone is a scoffer against the law, when they're struck for that, they're punished for that, he says that the simple will become weary. In other words, punishment for crime has is a deterrent. Even if it's not to the person who's being punished, the picture is bigger than them. The picture is society as a whole. What we're teaching the children. What we're teaching the next generation. And so a person, you can flog him almost to the point of death, and he won't, you know, turn from his way, and we say, well, the system doesn't work. But we don't realize that that may keep 1,000 from ever being in his place who are smarter than him. As long as there is that law, as long as there is that order and that justice. And so it does have that deterrent. You know, the crime rate is, it's interesting to watch how violent crime has plunged in the last few years. Absolutely corresponding to 3 strikes. I talked with a retired district attorney once, and he said, you know, this thing is going down based on the 3 strikes. And I know a lot of people didn't agree with it and all that kind of thing. And I don't wish to alienate you based upon that issue. Just make it an illustration. But recently at a prison, and the chaplain at the prison said, "We don't have room for the prisoners who want to come into the services now. I mean, there are so many of them that are so desperate to get going in their walk with the Lord, serious in their walk with the Lord, because they don't want that third strike. It has an effective side, but I'm going to bear real responsibility for my actions." And so there is that deterrent side of it. And if not for, you know, a handful that can't be moved by it, then society as a whole. Reprove one who has understanding, and he will discern knowledge. In other words, it's wiser to learn by verbal reproof than to be flogged. That's a wiser man yet. He who mistreats his father and chases away his mother is a son who causes reproach and or causes shame and brings reproach. I mean, that's a little ingrate, isn't it? You know, they wait till you get old and feeble and all, and then they're going to chase you around, and then they're going to chase mom and mistreat dad and hide the remote from them and the whole deal, you know, or whatever. But it is, it's a sad reflection on a child when there's that this kind of disrespect. There can be disagreements on things, and you can see things differently from your parents as we grow into adult life and do things differently. But there should be respect towards parents. And one of the things that happens as you grow older is oftentimes realizing what was sacrificed in order for us to have even the privileges that we did. And where there wasn't a sacrifice, you know, then you treat them with respect and honor what's honorable, just as unto the Lord. "Cease listening to instruction, my son, and you'll stray away from the words of knowledge." And so an exhortation to keep growing in the Lord. "A disreputable witness scorns justice," that is, he's a liar, "and the mouth of the wicked devours iniquity." So most justice systems in most countries are based upon honesty and unwillingness to lie among its general population. And once the fear of the Lord is gone, and once there isn't something built within me character-wise that says, "I'm not going to lie," now your judicial system is in big trouble, and ours is in big trouble this way. I remember talking with one brother in the fellowship, and he was involved in a motor vehicle accident. And he had the green light, and a guy, you know, blasted through on a red light. He and a friend in the vehicle, and totaled out his truck, you know, the brother's truck. And the guy said, "Listen, can I pay you cash? Can I not report this and the whole thing?" And the guy said, "No, I'm going to," and he called on his cell phone, called the police out there and everything. And then by the time the police came, both the guys in the other vehicle were saying that the other guy blew the red light. And the cops couldn't get a clear story on the thing and the way the accident was set up. They couldn't clearly get an idea of what happened, and there were no other witnesses. And so here the guy, I mean, that can upset you, that kind of thing. But the dishonesty, just the willingness to just flat out lie. And so it's a bad sign for a country, and it's a bad sign when it, is represented as heavily as it is in the high places in the United States of America. "Judgments are prepared for scoffers and beatings for the backs of fools." Things that go together. Judgment for scoffers, beatings for fools. "Wine is a mocker, and intoxicating drink arouses brawling, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise." Wine is a mocker. And how is it a mocker? Wine is a mocker in that it can make a person do foolish things. When they've had too much, and that you make a fool of yourself under the influence of wine. If I come under the control of wine, which is to mean I become, you know, drunk with wine. And so, and a lot of mocking towards the Lord or the things of the Lord. It comes out of, you know, a person is in love with wine. They're in love with drinking. He talks about intoxicating drink, and that doesn't just, you know, produce a mocker and produce mocking. It arouses brawling, you know. It'll turn a person into a fighter, and they're all beat up the next day. What happened to me? You know, I don't know. I just had about four drinks. That's all I remember, you know. And I'm innocent. And so that intoxicating drink, it arouses brawling. It turns people into fighters. And it is interesting in the summer months, you know, where you'll read in the articles in the paper and somebody's off to the hospital and there's been a shooting here and a beating here and a stabbing here. And I tell you, the alcohol plays such a place in it, the warm nights and people are drinking and the whole deal, and they come under the influence of it. Wine is made from grapes. When it talks about intoxicating drink, it's talking about hard liquor, what comes from grain. And it's interesting, he talks about a progression here. He talks about the wine that then leads to the hard drink, and then it talks about, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. In other words, gets hooked by it. And so often there is that progression in a person's life where there is that drinking of the wine, and then it turns into the hard drink, and then it turns into the alcoholic. And in the United States of America, the statistics are that 14% of all Americans who take their first taste of alcohol will end up alcoholics. That's a very, very high risk. And so the Bible teaches that, the Bible doesn't teach that it's wrong to have wine as a Christian. It tells us not to be drunk with wine. It tells us not to come under the influence of wine, not to come under the influence of anything except the person of the Holy Spirit. Paul wrote to Timothy and he said, take a little bit of wine for your constant stomach infirmities. Now, the alcohol level content of wine in those days, because it was basically a means of purifying water and it was the standard drink, alcohol level was, you know, 1 and 2%, not 12, 14, 18%, which can be the case today, or 8%. And so there just needs to be caution as it relates to that. And also the recognition that it really can lead from one to the next, to the next. And so you want to be very, very wise about that. Probably best to stay away from it altogether. But again, that's something that a person has to choose between them and the Lord, because there is liberty there. But not to become drunk. I want to be absolutely clear as it relates to that. You know? And I think in this culture, we have to be careful of our witness. Let me just ask you, do not shout out. I had a guy that wanted to help me this morning a little bit, but if I was up at Rico's on, you know, Tully and Standiford, and you walked in on me and I was having a pizza and I had a pitcher of beer there, would that be troubling for you? Yeah, I think for most people it would be. Well, what's the deal here? You know, tell me it's lemonade. Tell me something, you know, Pastor Damien, what do you got? You know, tell me it's near beer or something, you know, what we've got here. And I think that there is a place where we have to be careful in our own lives. I'll lay my liberty down, not to stumble another person. So, you know, I've told the pastors and the elders in this fellowship, I say, you know, if you want to drink wine in public and you just want to have a glass of wine with your pasta dinner, make sure it happens in New Hampshire and not here in town. And you want to exercise your liberty? Let's not goof people up. Let's not goof people up. And so there is a place where every culture is a little different. You're familiar with the fact that in Germany it's nothing. They drink beer like, you know, crazy there, even the Christians and all. And yet, why, to have a cup of coffee sends them off on a, you know, they can't believe the coffee that we drink. I can't either, but I love it. So, you know, but just to be wise related to it. Our witness is the most important thing, more important than our liberties. The wrath of a king is like a roaring lion. And so here's the king, an enforcer of the law, and his wrath against, you know, lawbreakers, it's to be like the roaring of a lion. In other words, there is to be a fear of breaking the law. There is to be a fear of being a lawbreaker. In fact, the fear should be as great to break the law as to run into a lion that's roaring, i.e. hungry. And so, you know, we think, oh boy, the standards are so high and everything, you know. There has to be something that produces fear within the heart of the person that wants to take up a life of crime. And whoever provokes the king to anger sins against his own life. In other words, he has the power of life and death. And so, speaking against rebellion against law and order and the wrath of the king against rebellion. And it makes us think about how much more the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. Somebody has said, and it's one of the most famous statements in Christianity, and I love it, and that is that every one of us will stand before the Lord Jesus, and we'll stand before him with one of two relationships. He will either be our judge or he'll be our Savior. And I never want to stand before Jesus and say, give me what I deserve. And I know you well enough, even if I don't know you, because I know you're like me, that you don't want to stand before him as a judge either. You want to stand before him as a Savior. It is honorable for a man to stop striving or get, the arguments going on. It's, the fights going on. It's honorable to walk away from it. Even if it looks like you've lost. Oh, look who left. Look who left the argument. No, if you leave that kind of an argument, you leave that kind of a fight that's just getting worse and worse, it's an honorable thing. People will respect that when they finally get some time to think it through. So it's honorable for a man to stop striving. Why? Since any fool can start a quarrel, and isn't that the truth? It doesn't take any genius to start a fight. The sluggard, here they are, will not, and you notice that will not, they will not plow because of winter. Oh, I'm not going out there plowing. It's winter time. Well, in the Middle East, that's the time you plow. You can't have a harvest without plowing in the winter time. It's just, it's just the way that it is. And so the sluggard will not plow because of the winter, therefore he'll beg during the harvest. Without plowing, you can't plant. And if you don't plant, you can't have a harvest. And so, there has to be that progression. Harvests come through hard work. And that's the way that it is. It comes through hard work, not through, wishing that it's going to happen. And so without hard work, I'm going to end up with nothing. God's a believer in hard work. Counsel in the heart of man is like deep water. I mean, there's deep things in our life, the deep streams in our life that we don't let everyone just see when they say, hey, isn't this, what sure thought today? Yeah, let me tell you all about the deep streams in my life. I mean, there's just stuff that's just tucked away in there. So counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. A good counselor draws out of a person's heart what's already in there. Most people already know what they need to do. Sometimes they don't, and you have to tell them biblically what's going on here. But a lot of times it's already there, and it's a matter of just talking with them and all, and letting them talk and all, and then just drawing out what they have to do. And the best counseling sessions are when the person feels that they've discovered the truth for themselves. I love it when someone, they come in and they get an appointment with me. And usually they have an appointment with me, maybe somebody close to them or whatever knows that they didn't. And say, how did the appointment go with Pastor Damien? Well, I guess it went all right. He's not much of a counselor. I mean, I like him otherwise, but he just sat there and listened, And I mean, as I sat there and talked in different things, it just became very clear to me what I ought to do. And he didn't help me at all, So don't waste your time talking to him. That's best. It's best when it works that kind of a way. And oftentimes it does. It's the best times are when it happens that way. Most men will proclaim each his own goodness, but who can find a faithful man? Every man will proclaim how good he is. Most men have a good self-assessment. Or women, too. I use men in the generic form. No snickering in here. And so you get a job application from people. Oh, man, you say, what do they want to work for me? They ought to be the grand poobah of the universe based upon what they've laid here. I mean, their estimation of themselves is just amazing. And then you hire them and you say, who can find a faithful man? Then you see the reality. Man, on paper, this guy was going to, turn us into a Fortune 500 company. And then he's come in the reality of it is that he's not faithful at all. And so there's a a big difference between, you know, the self-esteem and the reality so often. This is just a couple of years ago where they took the children in United States public schools, and we ranked at the bottom in several categories. We've improved in the last several years, but we ranked at the bottom in several categories as it relates to science and math and these kinds of things. But then they had a question. They determined of all of these Western industrialized nations, we rank near the bottom in all of those things, but we rank near the top in self-esteem. I mean, the kids just felt good about, you know, themselves, and it's just this whole thing. But it's not just the kids; they're part of a system that, you know, produces this kind of stuff. And so it's not enough just to have a real good high self-esteem or a real good impression of myself. I need to be faithful. I need to be a hard worker. You know, we ought to scrap some of the self-esteem stuff and just teach kids how to work hard. And you look at the business community today, and adults too, so I'm not, you know, getting all over the younger people, but the business community is absolutely dying for faithful workers. They can't find people who will work. They're not looking for people with high self-esteem. That's not really high on their list. They're looking for hard workers. And so that's what's needed. Not someone who can proclaim their own goodness and write out good resumes, but just good, hard workers. The righteous man walks in his integrity, and his children are blessed after him. And because of his integrity, because of his example, it's good for a child to be able to say concerning their dad, my dad didn't compromise. He wouldn't compromise. I had him as an example in life. It's a blessing. The king who sits on the throne of judgment, he scatters all evil with his eyes. So you come before the king, and you've done a crime. And man, now you stand before him, and you look him right in the eyes, and I mean, he scatters all evil. You don't want to be in that kind of a place. And so you don't want to be in front of the king when you're guilty. And so, again, the relationship to Jesus Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, I don't want to stand before him guilty. I don't want to see his eyes. I never want to see his eyes in that context. I never want to see his eyes as judge. I never want to see them as that. One of the things I look forward to in heaven is to look into his eyes. To look into his eyes. And the grace and the beauty and all of those things that just goes on forever behind those eyes. But I never want to see his eyes as the judge. I never want to see the disappointment. I never want to see the grief. I don't want to see the eyes in that context. Who can say, I've made my heart clean, I'm pure from my sin? Well, Paul said, there's none righteous, no, not one. No man can say that. Diverse weights and diverse measures, they are both alike an abomination to the Lord. And so the use of these weights for ripping people off, again, honesty. Now, I stop at it again, and made the potential of frustrating. But he keeps on saying the same thing. He just keeps on repeating it over and over and over again. The importance of honesty in business as a child of God. It must be very, very important. Even a child is known by his deeds, by whether what he does is pure and right. So we can't judge what a person is by just their outward appearance, but our deeds reveal, our fruit reveals. I'm never allowed to judge a person's heart or their motives. That's a judgment that Jesus forbids us to make as Christians, to look at someone at their exterior and then come to conclusions about them. That's forbidden because you can't know anything from the exterior. But I am called, not only free to, I'm exhorted to judge fruit, to judge actions. I am free to come to conclusions about a person's life based upon the choices that they make, the actions that they have, and the life that they choose to live. And so a child is known by their deeds. Well, if a child is, how much more a parent? And then in relationship to this, In verse 12, the hearing ear and the seeing eye, God has made both of them. In other words, it's tied to this doing by the child or the doing by the adult. Use your eyes, use your ears to come to a conclusion about a person and a situation. God's given them to us in order to understand what a person is about and what a situation is about. Make sure that we not only listen, but that we see it too. That's real wisdom. Do not love sleep, lest you come to poverty. And so if I love sleep more than I love to work, poverty's at the end of that. Open your eyes. In other words, get up and get out of bed, and you'll be satisfied with bread. In other words, you'll be able to work for your meal today. It is good for nothing, cries the buyer, and when he has gone away, he boasts. And so if you've ever been to Israel or into the Middle East and in those kinds of environments where there is the bartering, there aren't price tags on the stuff, and it can wear on you, where you come back to the United States and you say, oh, thank you for price tags, you know, and stuff, and because you may not get a bargain, but you're not, you know, getting ripped off as bad necessarily. But there's that whole buyer and seller thing where the buyer goes to the shop owner and says, what is this? It's a pink piece of junk. It's good for nothing, you know. And then he brings the price down and everything, and he walks away, and oh, I sure took advantage of him, you know, and they head out on that thing. And I, you know, I won't bring the whole auto dealership thing into this thing, but you know, it's a sales technique. It's a sales techniques used to rip off innocent people. God's not real hip to it. There is gold and a multitude of rubies, but the lips of knowledge are a precious jewel. As rare as gold is, and as rare and as precious as rubies are, there's something more rare and more precious than both of those, and that is the lips of knowledge. And much better to be found wearing lips of knowledge, lips carrying the word of God, than to be wearing gold and rubies. Take the garment of one who is surety for a stranger and hold it as a pledge when it's for a seductress. In other words, if you're going to lend money to someone who's untrustworthy, make sure you get some collateral. Bread gained by deceit or by dishonesty is sweet to the man, but afterwards his mouth will be filled with gravel. All right, I shafted that guy, and look at that, he got an extra loaf of bread out of it, and man, this tastes good. And then after a little while, it becomes like gravel in your mouth. Classic example from the scriptures, Judas. Judas. For 30 pieces of junky, rotten silver, he betrayed the Lord of glory. Sweet for a few minutes, sweet for a night, but afterwards it was gravel in his mouth. I mean, just no capacity to enjoy it. And that's the way that when you rip someone off, there's no capacity to enjoy. There is, even for the person who's not a Christian, there's that guilty conscience that God has put within mankind. And that's why, you know, you read in Ann Landers and stuff. I don't read Ann Landers. And it doesn't make me better than those of you who do. It just makes me one who uses my time better. But the, you know, they'll have those things where I remember reading it as a kid, and there'd be, you know, the shoplifter, after 50 years, he sends his 15 bucks into Woolworths. Well, he can't now. That's a bad illustration. They've gone bankrupt because of all the shoplifters. But anyway, they're just over that time. I ripped them off. I got this thing and, you know, and I stole the pocket knife from the store or whatever it might be. But every time you look at it, you know, you realize you're a thief. And so no, it just turns into gravel. Just turns into gravel. No ability to enjoy it. Every purpose is established by counsel, by wise counsel, wage war. In other words, it's not unspiritual to consult other people related to things you're dealing with. He who goes about is a talebearer, that is a gossip. They reveal secrets. Therefore, do not associate one with one who flatters with his lips. Don't share too much with a talebearer. Don't share too much with a gossip. Because if they come and they flatter you, While at the same time they're slandering someone else, you're next on the menu. And if you haven't lived long enough to know that that's the truth, just stay alive. And you'll find that out. But it is interesting, the methodology of the talebearer. One of the means by which they get the juicy tidbits is through that flattery. Therefore, do not associate with one who flatters with his lips. They loosen you up with flattery. Oh, you're the most this, and you're the most that, and you're this, and all that. And then, you know, pretty soon to get, you know, things coming forth from your life. And then next thing you know, everyone's going to know about it. Whoever curses his father or his mother, his lamp, literally, is, you know, the idea is his life will be put out in deep darkness. In other words, he's going to die. It was a violation of one of the Ten Commandments. You died when you disrespect towards parents under the old law. An inheritance gained hastily at the beginning will not be blessed at the end. In other words, if a person gets an inheritance too young in life, it's easy come, easy go. I mean, you give a young person gets that whole inheritance and young in life, and what do? They buy $1 million worth of candy bars. Or if they're a little bit older, they get just one series of sports cars after another, whatever, you know, kind of it might be. Well, I'm not saying you can't have a sports car, but I mean, they can just, the thing can just be gone overnight an inheritance kind of thing. There's something wonderful about, you know, receiving it a little bit later for it to last to the end. You know, there's something about growing older that you go through certain phases and then, you know, you don't want to spend all your money on those places and they end up in a little better places sometimes later in life when you get that inheritance, when life has prepared you for it a little better. Anyway. That'll die with me. Do not say, I will recompense evil or take revenge. Wait for the Lord. He will save you. And the Lord will avenge us. When somebody has done wrong against us and we say, okay, I'm going to, you know, there's another thought that I shouldn't use. And I'm going to, you know, repay evil for evil here. God says, don't. You leave revenge to me because you don't know how to handle it, and I will repay. And that's one of the things that gets lost about it. Not only does the Lord say, you leave revenge to me, but he makes that promise, I'll repay. I'll repay. I'll take care of it. I'll take care of it. Just leave it with me. Diverse weights are an abomination to the Lord, and a false balance is not good. Now, I just want, whichever one of you businessmen in here tonight, that he repeats this over and over and over and over again to get through to you. Pick it up there in verse 23 so we don't have to, you know, see this anymore. A man's steps are of the Lord. How then can a man understand his own way? And so it's talking about God's sovereignty. God is almighty, and so we just have to trust him to use his almightiness, to use his sovereignty to lead me in the way that he wants to lead me, and to put me in the steps that he has for me. But you know, while God is using his sovereignty to get us where he's trying to get us, a lot of confusion can reign. Because as he says here, how then can a man understand his own way? While God is getting us from point A to point B, sometimes when we're in the middle of it, we can't understand, we can't make heads or tails of it. Joseph, the Old Testament. God was going to save Israel. He's going to save the whole world through Joseph there in that part of the world in that day. And yet for years it looked like there was just nothing good was going to come out of it. And yet tonight you may be in that place. And there's just a thing where we just stop, we just look and we say, Lord, I trust your sovereignty. I really believe that you are almighty. And I believe that you're so almighty that you could change my circumstances in 1 second, but you're not. You're not doing it. You're keeping me here. And so I'm believing you for the fact that you're using your sovereignty for my good. And the fact of the matter is, as a believer, he'll do that. He'll always use it for my good. He's trustworthy on these things. It's a snare for a man to devote rashly something as holy and afterwards to reconsider his vows. So it just doesn't make sense to vow things to God. God, I promise that if you get me out of this, I'm going to give you $1 million, or I'm going to dedicate my life for the rest of my life, or I'm going to do, you know, none of that kind of stuff. We don't need to make vows to God. One of the reasons we shouldn't make vows in the New Testament is that vows are an expression of self-confidence. Yeah, I mean, we don't even know that we're going to breathe the next breath. Okay, we did. It can paralyze you with fear, can it? You know, and I think, let alone say, okay, I'm going to do this for you, God. And so, best just to stay away from vows altogether. A wise king sifts out the wicked and brings the threshing wheel over them. Whoa, wait, what do we got here? That's pretty heavy. And so, he's talking about law and order again. It's a wise king who separates the wicked from the general population when they're a danger to that population, and then, you know, brings forth the necessary punishment to make them understand not to do it again. And he talks about the threshing wheel being brought over them. That'd get my attention. Not the threshing wheel again. The spirit of a man is the lamp of the Lord, and searching all of the inner depths of his heart. And so only the Lord knows our hearts. Mercy and truth preserve the king, and by loving kindness, he upholds the thrones. Beautiful characteristics of a leader. Mercy, truth, loving kindness, or grace. The glory of young men is their strength, all those big muscles that they have. And the splendor of old men is their gray head. And so, you know, I saw a commercial one time, and the guy's on there, and he's got this gray beard, and he's got this gray hair and everything. And I looked in the mirror, and he said, and, you know, my gray hair just snuck up on me. I said, man, have you heard about any of these snoozer proverbs here? How in the world could that much gray hair sneak up on you, buddy? You know, it doesn't come, you don't get all white like that in a night sneak up on you. And so, you know, we have this fixation with youth in our culture. And youth is what it's catered to, and so there's this fear of getting old. There's this fear of being older and being gracious in being older. And so there's something wonderful about that gray, you know, head, that gray hair in the Lord, you know. And so it's a foolish thing for a nation to just cast off the gray heads for all the muscles. We need both of them. I mean, somebody's got to dig those ditches. Tough night for the young people. Just kidding. Here's one for you. Blows that hurt cleanse away evil, as do stripes the inner depths of the heart. And so chastening, it cleanses deep into our life. And so one of the reasons that the Lord, when we confess our sin to Him, one of the reasons that He not only forgives us, but then sometimes He will also discipline us in order to cleanse something away deep in my heart. And so there's the necessity of that.